Chapter 64. The Allies betray Kolchak. Admiral Kolchak followed his offensive by penetrating hundreds of more miles inside Soviet-held territory. It was at this very moment that the British government ordered all its troops out of Murmansk and Arkhangel. The Allied Supreme Council also reneged on its agreement to supply arms and food, all supplies were cut off. A horrible event compounded the Allied betrayal. As Kolchak was about to liberate Ekaterinburg, Trotsky's Jewish guard massacred in the most savage manner the Tsar, his wife and all his children, whom they held captive in a cellar. It was a ritualistic murder of unparalleled horror. The news sent shockwaves throughout Russia but only strengthened the resolve of the anti-communist forces to fight, if only to avoid a similar fate. Significantly, Ekaterinburg was renamed Sverdlovsk late after Trotsky's Jewish henchmen in the murder, Sverdlovsk. Churchill, who was war minister at the time, somehow decided to ignore the Allied Supreme Council. Alone among all the Allies, he ordered the British Navy to appear in Petrograd's harbor. The British sank two Soviet cruisers and were waiting for Finland to move in on Petrograd. Lenin knew all was lost. Finland was fully mobilized, the British Navy controlled the harbor and Russian nationalists under the command of General Yudenich were poised to attack. The destruction of communism seemed inevitable. As in the past and so many times in the future, communism was to be saved from certain annihilation by the capitalist powers. All the pressure the capitalists could muster was exerted on Finland to abandon its attack, Yudenich's supplies were sabotaged and Churchill reined in. The accumulation of betrayal finally took its toll on the nationalist forces. The momentum was lost, a jubilant Lenin, saved by his capitalist enemies, resumed his genocidal war against the Russian people. In a desperate counterattack, the Russian patriots wiped out six communist battalions on August 10, 1919, 2,000 Reds had been killed and 18 mortar guns taken. But nothing that Kolchak was able to do moved the Allies to help. In the gilded offices of the capitalist governments the word was out that now was the time to reach a permanent accommodation with the communists. Churchill waved an accusing finger at his colleagues. "From the bottom of your armchairs it seems easy to leave Russia and cut your losses. But how do you face the families who gave hospitality to the British troops and the Russian soldiers who fought on your side and the independent government created with your backing? How difficult and painful it is to cut such links." As if to appease a bad conscience, Churchill authorized those Russians who wanted to escape the coming genocide to board British ships out of Murmansk and Arkhangel. However, most of the northern Russian government members and the bulk of the patriotic troops remained on their native soil to face the enemy. On October 12, the last British vessel disappeared. Betrayed and without supplies, the Russians nevertheless resisted heroically for a month. Finally, they were overwhelmed by the sheer number of the communist troops. It was a total massacre, the Russian officers taken prisoners were shot at the rate of 500 per day. Churchill recalled the tragedy. "I can still see the pale faces and still eyes of a deputation of Arkhangel citizens. They asked the British protection be maintained, but I could only have given them a miserable answer. A few weeks later, all these poor workers and shopkeepers would be facing a firing squad. The responsibility for this falls on the powerful and enlightened nations, which after having won the war did not finish their tasks. While the people of Russia were being massacred or enslaved by an alien tyranny, the Treaty of Versailles was pontificating on the right of self-determination for all people. After the collapse of the Ukrainian, Finnish and Arctic fronts, the only remaining allies the Russians had were the 50,000 Czechs in eastern Siberia. The Japanese, the Americans and their satellites remained cautiously on the sidelines around the Vladivostok region. Admiral Kolchak was trying to coordinate the unruly and fractious Czechs with his anti-communist forces, which were themselves divided between disaffected socialists and old Tsarist loyalists. The Allies who had betrayed Kolchak in the West still had the nerve to pressure him into organizing elections. Kolchak reminded these champions of democracy that when elections had been held after Lenin's 1917 coup, the communists had only received 25% of the votes, and that the following day Lenin had dissolved the Congress. democracy had lasted only for 12 hours. Since then, the dictatorship of the proletariat had drowned the voters in a sea of blood. In order to have elections, Kolchak explained, the country should be out of range of the communist firing squads. For the Allied politicians, elections were nothing but a passport to the good life. It meant a long paid vacation, nurtured on lies, false promises, corruption, political auctions, and vacuous verbiage. They could not conceive of anyone not wanting such unlimited benefits. The Allies still flashed the hope of help in Kolchak's eyes if only he conformed to the democratic rituals. The British sent a left-wing socialist politician named John Ward to Kolchak's headquarters. Ward was blunt: no elections, no guns. In the middle of a war to the death with the communists, here was Kolchak being blackmailed by the hypocrites who just betrayed him in the West. Meanwhile, the Czech army had been placed under Allied command. A French general, Janin, was put in charge. The behavior of both the Czechs and Janin was disquieting. Churchill commented. At the beginning of 1919, the Czechs were no longer a help but a danger. They had committees like those who had undermined the Russian army after the revolution. Military discipline and valor were on the wane. It became necessary to withdraw them from the front and put them to guard the railways. Thus the Russians' last ally had been withdrawn from the Siberian front. The British Middlesex and Hampshire regiments would also be withdrawn from Vladivostok on September 8, 1919, and November 1 respectively. Their departure, said Churchill, sealed Kolchak's defeat. The Czechs protecting the Trans-Siberian railways had learned that Kolchak's own train was carrying 1,500,000 gold rubles, which had been salvaged from Trotsky's grasp. They saw immediately an opportunity to use both Kolchak and the gold to bargain their way out of the coming communist inferno. Instead of fulfilling their orders to ensure the safe passage of Kolchak to the east, they sent a delegation headed by General Janin, appointed by the Allied Supreme Council, to negotiate terms with the communists. The Czechs had now changed sides 5 times. On January 14, 1920, General Janin cynically offered a sordid bargain. Kolchak's train would be abandoned if the Reds would let the Czechs reach Vladivostok without any trouble. Russian officer Malinovsky recorded the vile operation. On January 14, at 6 in the evening, 2 Czech officers declared they had just received the order from General Janin to hand over Admiral Kolchak and his general staff to the local authorities. The admiral, always very calm, showed no sign that he feared death. His eyes were bright and, looking the Czech straight in the eyes, he said, "So this is the meaning of the promise Janin had made to ensure our safe passage to the east. This is an act of international treason." The local authorities referred to the socialist government of Irkutsk. Kolchak and his general staff were immediately seized and handed over to the socialists. They were thrown in jail, and the next day the socialists declared themselves won over to communism and opened the doors to Trotsky's Red Guards. They rushed to the jail and massacred Kolchak and his staff. The Allies, champions of democracy, who had so pressured the valiant Kolchak to observe democratic rituals, were remarkably silent about this flagrant lack of due process. To those who raised some criticism, Janin had only one answer: "I repeat that for His Majesty Nicholas II there was a lot less ceremony. As for the gold, it ended up being shared in strange and Byzantine ways between certain communists and certain Czechs." Several months later, a deposit of 1 million gold rubles was made in a San Francisco bank. Thus the Fourth Patriotic Russian Front collapsed thanks to Allied betrayal. The last and only front was still holding in southern Russia, under the command of General Denikin.